I'm Charles Wheeler with Clinic's office in San Francisco, and it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome the director of USCIS, Alejandra Mayorkas, or Ali, as I think you prefer to be called. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Here's how it's going to work. The director's going to give some opening remarks. I'm going to think up some questions to ask him in response to that. We're going to keep it kind of loose and informal, but we also have an audience filled with people, I think, who have burning questions that they would also like to ask you. So we're going to allow plenty of time for that as well. Take it away.
So thank you very much, and thanks to MPI and to Clinic for hosting this annual symposium. And thanks for joining us. I don't have prepared remarks, so I think I'll share some thoughts with you and really, Charles, open it up to you and to the audience to ask whatever questions you wish. Last year I walked into the Hartford Public Library because it was reported to me as a place of community action where individuals from different and diverse communities gathered together and used the public facility, and it was a force of integration. And I came to that public library in the course of our study of immigrant integration and how we can do better in that important mission set. And as I walked through the doors of the public library, I came upon a large wall on which was written the word welcome in many different languages. And it actually had a very important effect on me, and I can only imagine the effect it had on the immigrants from the Hartford community who visited the library for a multitude of reasons. And I thought that that word did very well to capture so much of what we at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services are about, and I thought it was a wonderful message to send not only externally to the community that deals with USCIS, but also internally to remind our workforce about what it is to be a part of USCIS and why one should join it and continue to serve that mission. And so any day now, every field office, every service center, every office in U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is going to have a large sign prominently displayed in its welcoming room that has the word welcome written in many different languages with a silhouette of the Statue of Liberty and the phrase, we are USCIS, we are America. And in the course of our work for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA as it is commonly known, everything in the government has an acronym, we had an operational meeting, as we do just about every day, to see how the program is progressing and to see, to ensure the quality of our work and the administration of this program. And there was a lament shared with me that one requester had submitted to our agency two or three file boxes full of documents to establish by preponderance of the evidence that individual's eligibility for the program. And it was presented to me as a lament because of the operational difficulties that two to three file boxes of documents presents. And if, in fact, we receive that volume for each requester, we are really going to be challenged in our administration of this program. And I had a very different reaction. I had the reaction of how powerful a message it sent, that episode sent, in two regards. Number one, the impact of this program on young people. And two, and quite importantly, the fact that this individual understood the importance of the program and basically was presenting his or her life to our agency. And that's what we deal with. We deal with people's lives. And connecting each and every member of USCIS to that core principle is really what we're going to be focusing on in 2013 in a myriad of ways. We are dealing with a demographic that is changing very significantly. Immigrants are moving into different communities and different populations. And what does that mean for an agency that is rather static in its location? How can we serve, since we are U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, how can we serve that changing demographic? Do we need to be nimble in the construction of our facilities? Do we need to have a more mobile model? Given the diversity of our customer base, does the 800 number really work for the very sophisticated customer, as well as the individual just asking the most rudimentary questions? We recently retained a company named IDEO, very creative in thinking, to develop for us a new design for our customer service architecture, to really hit the touch points, our web, our facilities, our phones, to see how we can better serve our customer base. How can we better integrate our national security and fraud detection mission in the context of a service agency? We have quite a number of initiatives underway. We have quite a number of initiatives planned for 2013. Rather than regale you with all of those, I'll leave it to Charles and to all of you to explore what you might be interested in. But connecting the agency to its mission is a core focus of the year ahead for us. Not just thinking about what operationally is practical, what operationally is realistic, but asking some fundamental questions before getting to those issues, I think, is a core area of our concern. Charles?
Well, my first questions go to the big issue, of course, deferred action, or DACA. And I think I speak for everybody in the room to say you've done an extraordinary job to implement a program in 60 days, what, from June 15th to August 15th?
Yes.
Unbelievable. How did you do it?
Thank you.
How were you able to pull it off?
Well, I will tell you, I will communicate that praise and the applause that followed to the workforce, because it's all about the workforce. And I don't know if there is, quite frankly, since I joined the agency, a challenge that has been presented to us that we have not met with the quality that we exhibited in DACA. You know, when I first started, the president had just announced the need to reform our website, to really create a new website in 90 days. And that's a Herculean undertaking from an IT perspective. And I have to tell you, people worked 24/7, and we did it. Shortly thereafter, in January of 2010, came the tragic earthquake in Haiti. And that was a monumental undertaking, and very high pressure because of the humanitarian urgency of saving orphans in Haiti. And we rose to the challenge. And I think this actually is yet another example of how we can do great things.
Well, let me ask you sort of the flip side of that, which is, in implementing this massive program, have you had to divert resources, staff, to away from what they were otherwise doing? And are applications starting to backlog in other areas?
So I'm not sure that we are necessarily at the replacement stage as opposed to right now the additive stage. This is an additional responsibility, and we'll see how long we can continue in that regard. But what we did, you know, it's interesting. We heard from the community that the community, at least from certain sectors of the community was hoping that our field offices would handle the DACA work. And when one starts to dissect the challenge ahead of us and understand the operational limitations as well as operational potential, we realized that really the service centers were best equipped to handle this implementation within 60 days. Why? Because our IT systems are built for the transmission of cases to the service centers. We can build on existing IT systems rather than try to build new ones at a time when we are also transforming the agency from a paper-based agency to an online environment. We can move work around with greater facility. And so what we've done is we've shifted some work around. We've changed the identity of the people who are doing work and tapping into pre-existing capacity very ably at the time that we are also surging in terms of hiring and adding additional resources to deal with this new volume. There may come a time when we will have to make very difficult prioritization decisions as to where can we best absorb an increased processing time with respect to an immigration benefit in order to serve this population of requests in a 4 to 6 month processing time framework that we have identified for ourselves, but so far so good.
You mentioned that this is now being adjudicated at 4 service centers, and I guess the question is, what has the agency done to guarantee some sort of uniformity, some training, some guidelines that all of them are using when they adjudicate these?
So we've done quite a bit, actually. One is that we have published internally uniform guidance. Consistency is, I think, a quality that everyone would like to see us have across all work that we do, and that's an effort underway. And we haven't achieved that goal, quite frankly, and I think as everyone understands. But with respect to this, we have one set of policies. We have one set of frequently asked questions. We have one set of standard operating procedures. We have had very intensive train-the-trainers seminars internally where everyone who will be training the adjudicators on the eligibility guidelines on the various factual issues and legal issues that can arise in this program, we've had them centralized and trained together. We have quality assurance mechanisms set up so that difficult issues percolate to headquarters so that there can be corporate decisions made on how to approach these difficult questions. So we're really monitoring the program in an exceptional way.
And what sort of things are left to be done with DACA in terms of implementation, in terms of the things that haven't been done yet?
I think I would say three things. Process, adjudicate, answer questions that the public has, because I think we've done a terrific job as a department in answering some significant questions that have arisen in the course of the implementation from the community. Assuredly, additional questions have come and will come, and we need to answer those questions in a real-time basis so there's clarity and consistency in what we're saying so that we can achieve clarity and consistency in our work.
Can you tell us anything about the decision so far? Any updated numbers? Anything in terms of the nature of the approvals? Are you approving just the easy ones now? How about the kids who have juvenile convictions or prior immigration violations? Are those being put at the bottom of the list?
So we don't have a protocol that says adjudicate the easy question, the easy issues first, and save the tough ones for last. It's really a first in, first out basis. I think that is what equity dictates, and I'm sure efficiency, or hopefully efficiency, follows equity in this context. The number of requests have progressed consistently since the inception of the program, so we've seen the steady volume of requests, and we have seen significant growth in adjudications. Because remember, people should understand that we get a request, and there are a number of steps that have to occur before a request is ready for adjudication. The individual, we're right now at a 48 to 72 hour time frame for the issuance of receipts, and we thought it very important to get a receipt into a requester's hands very quickly for transparency, and also an understanding that at least the requester knows that his or her request has been accepted as meeting the threshold for filing. Then within 21 to 28 days thereafter, on average, the individual will visit an application support center for the capture of the individual's biometrics. About 2 weeks after the request has been accepted for processing, we issue the notice of the application support center interview or appointment, I should say, because it's not an interview, it's an appointment. And then within about 2 weeks thereafter, a little less, the individual comes in. And we try to give some time to individuals so that they can manage their calendars, given a number of variables, work schedules, school schedules, geography, or what have you. So you're talking about a month lag between the time of a request and the time of the application support center appointment. Then the biometrics are screened against our background check capabilities, and then they are sent to a service center for completion, for adjudication. So you're talking about some time. We have the volume has increased steadily. We've ramped up our human resources capacity, and so we're seeing a significant growth in the number of completions.
So employers are obviously key to this issue, and they've shown some reluctance to be forthcoming with documentation that might indicate that a worker is unauthorized. Your agency issued, I think, an updated FAQ, which put on your website, which tried to address that issue, but it left the door open as well that you wouldn't turn a blind eye to, I guess, egregious violations, something like that.
The terminology was, I think it was egregious or widespread violations.
Okay. Are you anticipating any other kind of outreach or communications to the employee community to try to encourage them to come up with documentation?
So let me take the first half of that question. We are anticipating additional frequently asked questions on the employment issue. We've had a number of issues raised to our attention from the community with respect to more specific information, greater details, some questions that we had not thought of. We've heard from the Chamber of Commerce, from advocates on both the youth's behalf as well as employers' behalf, and so we're looking at those issues, and we intend to, you know, provide clarity where we can and guidance where we can on a real-time basis. So we are anticipating more guidance on a myriad of issues, including this important issue, Charles.
Last question on DACA. Do you see DACA and the way your agency has responded and the lessons you've learned so far as perhaps a dry run for DREAM Act or comprehensive immigration reform, should they be passed in our lifetime?
They will be passed in our lifetime, and I think that we were ready to implement legislation before this. I think that this is proof of our capabilities.
Let me turn to what I think is probably the second most important initiative, at least this year. We were all thrilled when your agency announced that it was going to change the procedure for adjudicating waivers. So now you have, or will soon have, something called pre-adjudication of waivers for people who otherwise have to leave the United States, endure a long waiting period, et cetera. And the rationale for changing that to pre-adjudication was so that they could keep families together during that adjudication period, as well as to avoid the violence, of course, that's raging in northern Mexico along the border. So we were also, I guess, disappointed when the preliminary regulation, the proposed regulation, limited pre-adjudication of waivers to immediate relatives, the U.S. citizens, spouses, and children, as in addition to unlawful presence waivers. So my question is your agency open or possible considering expanding that to include all family members as well as all potential waivers that could be filed?
So I think that proposed regulation is a perfect example of how a simple procedural fix can have such a significant substantive impact on people's lives, because and serve the purpose of legislation. There is legislation, there is law that provides that the time of separation between family members should be eliminated when the separation would work an extreme hardship. And what we were finding in the 601 waiver process was that because one had to leave the country in order to apply, and the duration of that departure could be quite extended, we weren't actually serving the legislative purpose most effectively. And by just allowing that provisional waiver process, an individual still has to leave the country to consummate the extreme hardship adjudication, both with respect to our department and the Department of State, but we're reducing the time of separation during the pendency of our evaluation of the request. It's just a simple procedural change. I know that there was both, I think, enthusiasm with respect to the announcement and disappointment with respect to its limitation, as you encapsulate, Charles. I have to say, I do think that we all have to do a better job of championing success as a momentum builder for future success. But be that as it may, that's just an editorial comment. I do think that, you know, I spoke at an immigrant integration conference at the University of Southern California, and I did make the comment that in difficult times, times of economic challenge, collaboration is so critical, but rhetoric matters. And I do think that we all who want to see more accomplished have to use whatever successes we do achieve as a terrific vehicle for accomplishing more success. The population impacted by the provisional waiver regulation as proposed is unknown. There have been estimates of what the population might be. That is an additional a variable that has a significant impact on our work, on our existing caseload, and our future plans. And so this is the framework that we have now. We'll see what the final rule, which is yet to be published, provides. But should the final rule reflect the proposed rule in terms of that framework, let's see what the population size is. Let's see how the agency does with respect to the implementation of that additional workload and take it step at a time.
Speaking of the regulatory process, a number of statutes have been passed over the last 5, 10, even 20 years that are being implemented by agency memos, series of memos. What can you tell us about the regulatory process in mind for putting some of those into notice and comment so that we can all chime in on how they should be implemented?
So one thing that one big change that we made in terms of the agency's historic promulgation of policy was that we would engage with the public before issuing policy memoranda, that subsequent to the engagement we would issue drafts for comment. It is not a substitute for regulatory conduct. I think it is a significant and material improvement over the historic promulgation of policies by edict. The fact of the matter is, it's just interesting. I look at the statutes in immigration law, and my first experience in the government, I served 12 years as a federal prosecutor working with the criminal justice system, and it was a much more cohesive statutory framework. Its objectives were punishment, deterrence, and rehabilitation, and one could see how there were anomalies, of course, but generally the criminal codes were geared towards those three objectives. Our overarching objectives as a nation in terms of our immigration laws are family unity, economic prosperity, and humanitarian relief, and it's not quite as a seamless a path to those three objectives in immigration law. One can see sometimes gaps in statutory provisions or conflicts as between one provision and another. And on top of that, and so it is quite a broken system, on top of that, one does not have historically a regulatory machinery at the agency that is functional. And so what we did just recently is we created a regulatory affairs division in our Office of Policy and Strategy that will be focused exclusively on the promulgation of regulations, and we are staffing it with additional resources to address the gap that you correctly identify. And so, for example, one area of expertise that we have lacked in abundance is economic expertise. One of the factors in promulgating regulations is analyzing and addressing the economic impact of a proposed regulation, and now we've staffed up with economists. So I hope and will push for a really functioning regulatory apparatus in the coming 12, 24 months.
My last question goes to the potential fiscal cliff. Federal budget negotiations are ongoing. If no compromise or agreement is reached, it could lead to automatic and deep cuts to your agency. What sort of contingency plans do you have in mind? And would application fees, for example, for DACA be diverted to other services?
So we finished our fee study, and we have not raised our fees in 2012. The sequestration looms, and we are in the process of assessing the impact that that would have if it should come to pass on our agency. The preliminary analysis is that, even though we're a fee-for-services agency, we would not be immune from its impact, and we're assessing it very carefully, but I can't draw any conclusions just yet.
So now let's open it up for questions from the audience. I think we have the same two people who are walking the rooms with mics. I'm going to be relatively arbitrary here. Let's start here with this man.
My name is David North. I'm with the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank here in Washington, D.C. It is inevitable, and I think you'll agree, that in any government program there will be some degree of fraud, and there must be at least something in the way of a fraud threat in the DACA program. And my question, sir, relates to your use of the term completions. And I sense a completion is the decision made of some kind regarding a DACA applicant. Could you answer two questions, one of which is, how many of those completions are approvals and how many are denials? And secondly, to what extent have you found it necessary to have people actually interviewed by human beings about the nature of their application?
So, David, let me say that there's no program that I have encountered that is free from the threat of fraud, and I think, as you know, we have worked quite vigilantly to address the potential of fraud in every program and protect the integrity of the system, and this one is no different. So I don't have the statistics at my fingertips with respect to the number of completions, and of those completions, how many approvals, how many denials. But we, if in fact fraud is suspected, one of the avenues that we are prepared to employ is an in-person interview of the requester. In addition, we have law enforcement-sensitive fraud bulletins circulated within the workforce to identify issues or patterns or, for example, just hypothetically, if we were to identify a company that we suspected of producing fabricated school records, the identity of that suspect would be communicated to our workforce so that we're all aware in real time. We're also using the interviews not just for fraud concerns, but frankly as a quality assurance mechanism as a whole. We're randomly pulling some cases for interviews to ensure the quality of our work.
There's a question over here. All right, let's go up there now. Okay, Jim. Jim Tom.
Hi, I'm Jim Tom Haynes. I practice immigration law here in Washington. You mentioned the threshold for filing that generates the receipt. I'm just curious to know if that involves a look at to see if the applicant arrived before the time that he was supposed to, or that he's not too old? Do you fee everything in, or do you reject some out of hand because they obviously don't qualify?
So there are some very elementary factors that we'll take a look at. The request was not signed. The check did not accompany the request. I'm not sure, as I sit here now, whether if the individual is obviously over the age of eligibility, whether that's one that triggers a rejection at the lockbox at the intake stage, or whether that's something subsequent. It might be something subsequent. I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer. But these are there. What we did was we were issuing a tip sheet that we updated in real time. So we started seeing early on in the first week a number of requests that weren't signed. We published a tip sheet. Make sure you sign your request. Make sure you send in your check. If you don't send in your check and you haven't already received an exemption, which is in limited circumstances, it'll be rejected. It'll be bounced back to you. And you can resubmit.
Another question. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Christina Fry. My question is, those who are rejected are going to be deported? Deported.
Deported.
So it depends on the reason for the rejection. We have a notice to appear in NTA policy that our agency published. That is our guidance as to when an individual is to be referred to the enforcement agency for removal, and that is the architecture that controls our agency, and the deferred action for childhood arrivals process is not being administered outside of that architecture, but rather from within it. And that policy, the NTA policy, is available publicly and sets forth the criteria that trigger a notice to appear. So with respect to David's concern, fraud on USCIS, an effort to misrepresent facts or conceal material facts in the application or request process would be a priority for the issuance of a notice to appear. A threat to national security, public safety, as the NTA policy defines. And we've also addressed that. So I would look at the notice to appear policy, and I would also look at the frequently asked questions that are on our website, because that spells out some further detail in that regard.
Question in the back on the aisle.
Hello, I'm Johnny Young with the Migration and Refugee Services of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Thank you so much, Director Mayorkas, for your leadership. You have really made a difference. We can see it in terms of customer service and transparency and accountability. Based on what we're reading in the press, there seems to be a fairly substantial number of possible eligibles for DACA who are reluctant to come forward because they're afraid that the information they volunteer may be used against them. What's being done to give greater confidence to this population?
So, Ambassador, I can speak anecdotally to the what I'm hearing in the community with respect to a hesitancy amongst some. One of the reasons that I have certainly heard is a concern that really, frankly, dovetails with the question that was just posed, a concern that if, in fact, I, as a requester, submit my information to the government, there's a fear of removal. We have articulated in the frequently asked questions, which is our guidance to the public, as well as the documentation itself, we've provided for levels of confidentiality with respect to the information that is provided to us. There are exceptions to that. Those confidentiality provisions, but they are there, and they amplify, I think, some of they amplify the framework that we set forth in our notice to appear guidance. So a declination, if in fact someone's request for deferred action is not granted, that does not necessarily trigger a notice to appear, nor does it necessarily trigger the provision of the underlying information to the enforcement authorities. And I think we've been very, very clear and very strong in our communication of those provisions.
Yes, on the aisle.
Hi, I'm Amy Blistani from World Relief, and also would like to commend you for the great job you've done over the last few months with all of your staff. Just one recommendation. We very much appreciate the FAQs. They keep getting longer and longer, which is good, but also means we keep rereading them over and over to see what has changed. So if there would be a way to maybe highlight the changes, that would be helpful, I think, to busy advocates in the field and the children as well. Thank you.
We should. That's a good idea. We'll do that.
Thank you. Put them in different colors, maybe. Might hurt. Highlight. Over here.
Father Ippolito, Catholic Charities, Diocese of Raleigh. I sent in 207 cases on August 18th, and the approvals have started coming in already. Thank you for your wonderful work. But you mentioned checks. Sometimes the people don't have all the money, and the checks go in two money orders, not checks, but money orders. And some of them are like 200 and 265. Some of those checks were accepted, but some were sent back because they were the incorrect amount, even though the total was 465. It wasn't 365 and 80 or whatever it is, because some were accepted and some were sent back. And so those people have to go back and try and see if they can get the money back from the money order and then make one check for $465. So if they could just take all the money, as long as it totals $465, that would be wonderful.
So I'm wondering why that would happen, because there's no requirement that it be, you know, one check, one money order, but rather that the amount submitted be correct in the aggregate. I wonder whether there was, if some people, because you've been working with a group of people to submit requests, whether they could have possibly grouped their requests together? They were all segregated individually?
Each one was sent in a separate envelope.
So let's circle back with one another at the end of this, because that shouldn't have been the case, but the money order should have been returned to the individual, and if they've submitted the full amount, we shouldn't have turned it away.
Time for one, maybe two more questions on the side.
Hi, my name is Kate Sinkins. I practice immigration law here in D.C. What's going to happen to the pending DACA cases if a different administration does come in?
Unthinkable.
So you have confused me with Nostradamus, because I can only speak to the efforts that we are making now and not what someone else might decide with respect to the program.
Last question. Yes, in the middle.
I'll repeat your question.
USCIS has done a great job of releasing some initial statistics and information about the program.
USCIS has done a great job.
USCIS continues to release that sort of information in addition to other information such as denials, RFEs, and total cost of the program.
It is our plan to do so, and we're looking at what the frequency of those of that publication would be.
Well, in an effort to keep us right on time, I want to thank you again for coming and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, all of you.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.